This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When we go out for that fish fry on Friday night, we usually have a few options on the menu, maybe the cod, the walleye, or the perch. Thanks to some new work being done through UW Green Bay, that perch has become more common and affordable. This project aims to hatch and raise yellow perch in captivity. It would be hatched at the Farmery, that's a nonprofit group in Green Bay. The fish, which are becoming tougher to find in the wild, would then make their way to farms around the state to keep growing. Ken Webb is a fish biologist and associate researcher at UW Green Bay. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me.
All right, first of all, talk about the yellow perch on the eating side of things. This is a pretty popular fish that we're having a hard time getting a good supply of, right?
Absolutely. Yellow perch has traditionally been a staple in the Midwest and in Wisconsin specifically. And, you know, nowadays with the way the fisheries are going, there's just not that many out there to catch anymore in the U.S. And pretty much every yellow perch you eat, with a few exceptions, is coming from Canada these days. It's all imported. It's out of a small number of lakes. And it's definitely not something that is very sustainable the way it's being managed.
So it seems like the obvious answer is, okay, we'll farm yellow perch, but as I read up on this, easier said than done.
Absolutely. Yellow perch are what we call an altricial larva, which means that when they're very young, when they first hatch, they're little protoplasmic blobs. They're not really very good at anything. And altricial larvae, like the yellow perch, more than 90% of the mortalities they will ever experience through their whole lifetime occurs in that first month of life. So any changes we can make in upping that survival can make huge improvements, huge, huge differences in the number of perch both in the pond and eventually hopefully back out in the lakes.
All right, that's where you come in now, you and your partners over at the Farmery. Talk about what exactly you're doing.
So the Farmery is a nonprofit, as you mentioned, and its goal is really to kind of re-energize fish farming in Wisconsin through its hatchery initiative. There has been a lot of work in Wisconsin and through the Midwest in general, but there's been a lot of work in Wisconsin in trying to get the yellow perch into hatchery production. Milwaukee has an active program. Stevens Point has had an on and off program over a number of years, and it just turns out they're really, really difficult to raise in any appreciable numbers in captivity. And that's mainly because, as I mentioned before, they're altricial larvae. So what we're trying to do a little bit different is we're investing a lot of the upfront technology costs. We're putting people who have a lot of experience with raising larval fish, a lot of technology, and we're investing it so that fish farmers don't have to, so that they don't have to have that person that has a PhD and, you know, a computer science background to put their system together. So our goal is we're going to make the fingerling part easier to acquire. So most producers, they are ready to take fingerlings, little 4 to 6 inch perch, put them out in their ponds, grow them up over the year, and then at the end of the summer, harvest their ponds and take their fish. Right now, they can't do that because there's simply nobody around that can provide enough fish, fingerling size, to make that a stable industry. We're trying to step in and fill that gap, and at the same time, train a new generation of people to meet those needs so that they can go out and set up their own fish hatcheries and kind of bootstrap this industry back into profitability.
So give us a sense of what it takes to help these yellow perch larvae make it to adulthood, or to fingerling status is all you're getting to, and get that, 90% mortality rate down a piece.
Absolutely. So it seems funny to say, but yellow perch, when they're larvae, they have a very limited ability to perceive food in the water column. Whether it's a fish food or whether it's something alive that we've added to the tank, they have a very limited visual field of where they can see food. So in essence, we basically have to take food and rain it in front of the fish all the time, so that if they feel just a little bit hungry, there's food right there waiting to be consumed. Now, the problem with that, of course, is when you fill a tank with food like that, it rapidly becomes a problem. You get contamination problems. You get lots of waste at the bottom of the tank that actually harms the fish in the process. So what we're doing is we've got some systems designed with some pretty practically minded people who have done this for a number of years, and these systems essentially clean the tanks all the time so that we can basically make sure that there's always food in the water so that the fish can eat it. Because the problem with these yellow perch is they have a very narrow time window of when they're able to consume food and they have to eat it. If they miss that time window, if they're late by a couple of hours, they've passed what we call the critical period, and it doesn't matter what we do after that, they're still going to die. So in order to get those fish through that 90% mortality, we need to give them as much good food as possible with high-quality water and make sure that if they want to eat, they can eat.
And Ken, as we wrap up, this is probably about raising fish, but you also mentioned this is raising future fish farmers. So are we talking UW Green Bay students, maybe youth in the Green Bay area? Who's getting involved via the farmery?
Right now, the farmery is primarily a partnership between UW Green Bay and the farmery itself. I have student interns that I'm interviewing for the next semester and oncoming semesters that we're bringing some of the students who have an interest in to work in the hatchery itself. But moving forward, we're looking at all kinds of collaborations with NWTC and St. Norbert's and anybody else who's interested, because really, this is not about parochialism. This is about let's build an industry that everybody wants. Everybody wants fresh, farm-raised perch on their table coming from Wisconsin growers and not from some other place. We want those jobs, and we want them now. We just need to train those people. So right now, it's only UWGB, but that's expected to grow.
Ken, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Great. Thank you, Rob.
That's Ken Webb, fish biologist and associate researcher at UW Green Bay, talking about this plan to hatch and raise yellow perch in captivity along with the farmery in Green Bay. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Happiness is something most of us want, but it turns out there are different kinds of happiness. And if we want to be happy, it might help if we start by figuring out which kind of happiness we want to pursue. A recent series of studies asked people to choose what kind of happiness they want from two types, called experienced happiness versus remembered happiness. Cassie McGillner-Holmes is the Justice Elwood Lee Endowed Term Chair in Management and an Associate Professor of Marketing and Behavioral Decision Making at the Anderson School of Management at the University of California, Los Angeles. She studies happiness. Cassie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've got two different kinds of happiness we're looking at here, experienced and remembered happiness. Can you explain what we mean by both of those?
Yeah, so experienced happiness is or captures that over the course of time, you know, moment to moment, feeling happy in the moment, whereas remembered happiness, it's looking back on a period of time and feeling happy as you remember it. And so this has actually been described as sort of being happy in your life for the experienced happiness versus being happy about your life as you sort of reflect back and assess your happiness.
And examples you give in your research, maybe I'm happy watching TV right now, yay, but years from now I'm not going to think back about that hour I spent watching TV. I might not be happy now, taking care of a kid. Years from now I might remember that happily. Is that a good way to distinguish those?
Yeah, exactly. So actually, I mean, a lot of times things that you experience happily are also remembered happily. So actually a correlation quite high at sort of 0.5, but the pieces that you picked out is that it's not perfectly correlated. So there are instances or activities or experience or sort of periods of time where you experience it as happy but don't necessarily remember it. So, and then the flip of that where you remember it happy even though in the moment it wasn't particularly fun.
And then part of what you try to do is figure out which kind of happy makes us happier. How did you try to do that? How did you go out to people and try to suss that out?
Yeah, so we actually can't say which is the better form of happiness, but we did go out and ask people which form of happiness they would prefer if they had to choose. And so we asked sort of thousands of Americans from across the country, different ages, income levels, employment status, marital status, et cetera, the simple question, if you had to choose for your life, which form of happiness would you prefer, experienced or remembered happiness? And then we also asked people, which would you prefer for a year, experienced or remembered happiness? And then we also asked folks for a day and for the next hour. And what we found was that when people were thinking about their life overall, or their year, or even actually over the course of months, there was most people, around 75% of people, said they would prefer to experience their life as happy. Now, interestingly, while you see the sort of general preference for experienced happiness, we did see actually that when people are thinking about their upcoming hour or day, then actually the choice is less clear. And so there you saw about half of the people said they would prefer experienced happiness, half said they would remember or prefer remembered happiness.
That actually is the opposite of what I would have expected. I thought if you'd say, oh, in the next minute or hour, yeah, I want to be happy right now. And then when you start to take the long view, then you want those cherished memories, but that's not how it came out.
Yeah, so I think that what we're picking up on, and which we don't give our sort of fellow Americans credit for, is that there's this sort of Protestant work ethic that underlies some of our decision-making, where we want to work hard so that later we can look back and feel sort of good about ourselves. And I think that that's what's getting picked up, and this sort of productivity orientation or desire to be productive that gets picked up when people are thinking about how they're going to be spending their next hour.
Now, is there, from this and your other research, is there some guidance here for how we try to plan for happiness, how we try to decide how we're going to use our time and get happy from it?
Well, I think the implication of this research, this particular piece, is that if happiness is what you're pursuing for your life, is to think about your life as a whole when you're making decisions hour by hour, so that you sort of pull in that broader philosophy of how you want to live and who you want to be in the day-to-day, because what this research suggests is that people's preferences don't necessarily line up from their hours to their life overall. And now, in terms of my research more broadly, in terms of how people should be spending their time in order to feel happy, I think that the conclusions there are maybe actually a little more helpful, is to identify what are those ways of spending time that you actually experience as happy and remember happily, so that you can sort of maximize both. And my research, as well as a bunch of the research in looking at determinants of happiness, picks up on the role of social connection and spending quality time with loved ones, whether that's friends or family or even, good friends at work. And so it's those sort of connecting experiences that are both experienced happily and remembered happily.
It's a great place to leave it. Thanks to our guest, Cassie McGillner-Holmes. She's with the University of California, Los Angeles. She's a happiness researcher. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Scientists around the world were shocked by a claim from a Chinese scientist who said he had successfully altered the genome of human embryos, ultimately leading to the birth of a pair of twin girls who were born a few weeks ago. He Zhenkui announced via YouTube that he had used CRISPR technology to make a set of twin girls who he referred to under the pseudonyms Lulu and Nana immune to HIV.
No gene was changed except the one to prevent HIV infection. The girls are safe, healthy as any other babies.
He was widely criticized for his claim at the Summit on Human Genome Editing in Hong Kong last week. Alta Shero is a professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Alta, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my pleasure.
Well, you were at that conference last week after this news dropped. What was the buzz? What was the feeling among experts about this announcement?
Well, first, I should mention I was a member of the organizing committee for the summit. So we got news that this might be happening about 36 hours before. And for our purposes, one of the big questions was whether or not to put him on, since much of what he was describing struck us as being unethical and premature. Once it became public knowledge, and he was definitely going to be presenting in the name of transparency, and we thought a chance for the scientific community to critique his work, the journalism interest just exploded, and we were swamped. And almost without exception, the journalists and the scientists and the ethicists and all the others there were very concerned that this research had been done without proper authority, without proper oversight, and frankly, without having met the basic criterion of a real unmet need.
Do we know? It seems like there's still some question over whether this researcher, has actually done what he has said he's done. Do we? How certain are we that this has actually happened?
We don't yet have independent verification. The Chinese government has just yesterday announced that it is setting up an investigational committee. It's already identified two people to lead that effort, one of whom was a member of our summit organizing committee and also was a member of the report that I co-chaired for the National Academies a year ago. And so we now will have a definitive finding from this group, which will ultimately include scientists from outside China. But that said, I have a feeling that, in fact, he did do what he suggested, if only because when he put up the limited data that he was willing to share, it did seem to document adequately the number of steps you would take, although, interestingly, it also seemed to document that he actually didn't accomplish quite what he claims to have accomplished.
Let's talk about what he specifically was trying to accomplish. As he presents it, he says, okay, we've got a couple. The father has AIDS. He is trying to use this CRISPR technology to alter the genetic code of these girls and make them resistant, to flip a switch basically and make it so they couldn't be infected by HIV. Can you talk about that as a goal and from what you were just saying, whether or not he accomplished that goal and if this is the best way to do that?
Okay, that's a lot.
That was a lot. Sorry, yeah.
No, that's fine. So the first thing you have to understand is that we have very effective ways of preventing the transmission of HIV to children during the period of pregnancy. And that has been developed over years with various drug regimens that can be given to the pregnant woman while she is pregnant if she herself is HIV positive. What's interesting here is that if his goal had been to protect children from being infected during the pregnancy, number one, he ignored the existing options. And number two, they weren't really at risk of that because it wasn't the mother who was HIV positive. It was the father. And when it's the father who's HIV positive, we have a standard approach called sperm washing, which can render the risk of transmitting the virus to virtually zero. And indeed, it's always confusing with he and her. Dr. Fuss actually did engage in the sperm washing. So these children were going to be born HIV negative regardless of what he did. Well, what is it that he claims he did? There is a particular variant of a gene that is known throughout Northern Europe predominantly for a minority of people that makes them resistant to infection from HIV. It doesn't, by the way, exist widely in Asia. He claimed to then have altered the genome of these embryos in order to match that particular mutation that we see in Europe, the goal being that the children would then be themselves HIV resistant. Now, one problem with this is that genes don't operate in isolation. They're in a context. And for all we know, not only is the gene frequency different in Europe and Asia, but there may be other genes that are different in Europe and Asia in terms of frequency, so that this particular gene, the CCR5, won't operate the same way for children born in Asia because they won't have the same surrounding genetic material that affects everything. The second is that a genetic change can seem positive because it reduces the risk of disease, but it can also wind up increasing your risk of other diseases. So if you, for example, look in Africa, the sickle cell trait, when you only have one copy of it, doesn't make you sick from sickle cell, but it does give you some protection from malaria. In this case, the CCR5 appears to offer some protection against HIV infection, but renders you somewhat more vulnerable to West Nile virus and perhaps even influenza. And we all know that influenza is a major problem in Asia particularly. And third, for his purposes, the only thing that would accomplish anything is to have both copies of the gene on both chromosomes changed. And he himself admits that in one case, there was only one copy that got integrated, one edited version that got integrated. So that second child, even if there was some protection to be had, wouldn't get it. But he implanted that embryo anyway. Last, why do I say it's not clear he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish? The scientists I've talked to, looking at some of the data that he presented, and it was really not complete, but looking at it suggests that he didn't actually make exactly the same deletions to give the variation that we see in Europe, but came up with something else. And so we're not really sure whether or not it really would have the same function of protecting against HIV. So no unmet need, because we have other ways to prevent transmission, and they weren't at risk anyway. Some possibility of increasing risk of other diseases, and some possibility that whatever he did wouldn't even confer the purported benefit he claimed.
Supposing we can agree as a world, as a scientific community, that, okay, there is a valid use of CRISPR technology, of this genetic editing to prevent a disease. I don't know which one yet. What is the ethical way, the right way to proceed and make that a reality?
Well, first, you focus on those things that have lower risk but very good value. And we're already seeing clinical trials, not of this kind of editing of embryos, which creates an inherited difference that would go down through the generations, but so-called somatic editing, where you take a child or an adult, you make a change, and it's that child or adult who benefits, but it doesn't get inherited. That simplifies the process of evaluating the risks and benefits. And we already have clinical trials going forward now with things like various kinds of blood disorders, muscular dystrophy, and now a particular kind of retinal eye disease. So that's the first thing you do, is you focus on the areas in which you have a high degree of confidence you'll have benefit while minimizing risk. When it comes to doing something that might be inherited, historically this was viewed as unacceptable, but of course it wasn't even possible, so it was an easy thing to say. Now that we know that it is technically feasible, the question is, when would you use it? And our recommendation from the National Academies report that we wrote and from other national bodies that are looking at this is that you use it essentially as a last resort. Because for most diseases that you might want to correct in the embryo, it's easier and less risky to correct it after birth. So there'll be very few situations where correcting in the embryo is really the only way to prevent the disease. And even there, for those people who are willing to accept the loss of embryos, the easiest thing to do is to biopsy the embryos and only bring into a pregnancy and to term the embryos that are free of this genetic problem. So again, very, very limited situations where there might be a compelling need to do something for which there are no good alternatives. And then you would do it with a lot of supervision, really rigorous preclinical research, so you know what you're doing.
Now, as you said, it wasn't that long ago that we couldn't do this at all. Now it's getting easier and easier, not so easy, I can do it. But more and more institutions will have the capacity to do this, maybe private businesses, independent researchers. Is the genie out of the bottle, no matter what academies of science say? Is somebody going to be out there pushing this envelope?
Well, if somebody tries to do it in the United States, regardless of whether they are at an institution or in a private sector, it would be illegal, because this transfer of an edited embryo is considered to be a transplantation of a human cell or tissue therapy, and that's regulated by the FDA. And if you don't have permission to start that, you can't do it, and it's a civil and criminal offense. Other countries have similar rules. So, no, I don't think the genie's out of the bottle, but I do think that people are now going to be imagining uses that before they wouldn't have bothered with.
Do we have the legal framework in the United States and other countries that we need, given this evolving technology?
I believe that we do have the framework we need in the United States. I also believe that there are other countries, the United Kingdom, the European countries through the European Medicines Agency, Japan, Singapore, Australia, all have robust regulatory systems. China also has laws against this, and right now he's being investigated for that as well. But even if you have laws and regulations, nothing is going to be absolutely perfect. No law can prevent the rogue criminal or the rogue scientist completely.
We'll leave it there. Alta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Alta Shero is a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about the controversy surrounding claims of genetically editing human embryos by a researcher in China, some of the potential legal and ethical considerations surrounding that as well.